Today is Wednesday, May 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Congress looks to its next move after another former Trump official defies a subpoena.
Republican legislatures are waging a war to unravel a woman's fundamental rights. They are responsible for 300 newly proposed restrictions. We are here to send these folks a message, not on our watch.
Protesters fight against strict abortion laws. Also ahead, the late Aretha Franklin's will has been found, and there are more than one. It's all on today's International Edition. Former White House counsel Don McGahn ignored a committee subpoena and failed to show up for the hearing on Tuesday at the instruction of the White House, which told him not to testify. Democrats on the committee have been eager to hear from McGahn and want to question him about potential obstruction of justice by Trump based on episodes outlined in the report by special counsel Robert Mueller in his investigation into Russian interference into the 2016 election. The chair of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee, Gerald Nadler, is threatening to hold McGahn in contempt of Congress for his refusal to testify. Later Tuesday, Nadler announced he had issued more subpoenas, this time to former White House Communications Director Hope Hicks and Annie Donaldson, the former chief of staff to then White House counsel Donald McGahn. The subpoenas both seek testimony and documents in connection with the committee's probe into whether President Trump obstructed special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. Joining us to talk more about it is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Jack, why are they sending out all these subpoenas, particularly since they're all being defied?
Right now, it's clear that the House is trying to create a paper trail to include the fact that the president, specifically, the president is stopping them from speaking. He is obstructing not just in the past, not just in the Mueller report, not just when it came to the Russians, but the investigation that's taking place on a daily basis subsequent to that.
My understanding is that Congress is a co-equal branch of government, and they have one of their jobs is to provide oversight of the White House. Otherwise, there would be no checks and balances, and, you know, no one is above the law, supposedly in the United States. So how is it that the White House is ordering people not to testify? The Justice Department is ignoring subpoenas. How is this being allowed to happen, and what kind of recourse does Congress have?
Congress is an equal branch of government, and they have a constitutional requirement to provide oversight for the other branches. This is what they're obligated to do. The president has some limited power when it comes to executive authority and executive privilege, but that still doesn't protect him if there's criminal activity, if there's wrongdoing. And this constitutional obligation of the House requires that they have the ability to have a subpoena to force people to come in and testify. The president doesn't have the ability to simply say, yeah, you know what, I don't think so because I don't like what the answer is. And I think that's really what we're looking at right now.
Have we ever seen anything like this where a White House would just defy subpoenas and defy requests that are they're legally allowed to do, you know, such as the president's tax returns or the Mueller report or any of this, subpoenaing people to testify?
It's fascinating. We bandy about the phrase constitutional crisis, but we're actually in one right now, because what we're really looking at is the question of an issue that we have never seen. Even if you go back to Nixon, some of the arguments that Trump is making right now are the very same argument that Nixon was making all of those years ago. And finally, they backed down. The problem is because it was never actually clarified by the Supremes, by the Supreme Court on this issue, what we're finding is they're making the argument that it's still, quote unquote, good law. And that's really the argument that we're seeing. This will end up in front of the Supreme Court. And my expectation here is that the Supreme Court still has to come down on equal powers of the government, meaning the legislative branch, the judicial branch, the executive branch, and each has their obligation to do what they do. And that may cause some problems for the president in the long term.
All right, that is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Thank you for your perspective. Activists led rallies across the United States on Tuesday, including outside of the U.S. Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., to protest states adding new bans against women seeking abortions, which were made legal in the landmark 1973 case Roe v. Wade. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
Groups like NARAL Pro-Choice are vowing to fight against laws that block women from getting access to abortions.
These anti-choice forces are coming for women, they're coming for doctors, and they're coming for Roe.
NARAL President Elise Hoag says new restrictions are designed to get the Supreme Court to ultimately overturn Roe v. Wade.
We stand together to call out politicians who talk so much about life, but don't seem to care about the lives of more than half of the population.
Vote them out!
While the activists are vowing to vote out lawmakers who work to restrict abortions this weekend, the vice president dug in.
Without apology for the sanctity of human life.
Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The U.S. says Syria may be using chemical weapons again. A new audit finds U.S. broadcasting to Cuba rife with bad journalism and ineffective propaganda. The Islamic State in Afghanistan is growing bigger and more dangerous. And the future of food is up on the roof. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Members of Congress on Tuesday said U.S. officials who briefed them about Iran sought to convince them that the Trump administration wants to deter Tehran's aggression, not attack the Islamic Republic. Acting Defense or Secretary of Defense Patrick Shanahan spoke to reporters about the briefing.
Our biggest focus at this point is to prevent Iranian miscalculation. We do not want the situation to escalate. This is about deterrence, not about war.
Well, Tehran and Washington have been escalating rhetoric against each other in recent weeks following Trump's decision to try to cut Iran's oil exports to zero and beef up the U.S. military presence in the Gulf in response to what the president said were Iranian threats. Trump said the tightened sanctions were intended to push Iran to make concessions beyond the terms of the 2015 international deal to curb Iran's nuclear program. Trump withdrew the United States from the pact a year ago. International Edition's Steve Miller spoke with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb to learn more about the secretary's briefing.
Well, Acting Secretary of Defense Pat Shanahan did speak to reporters earlier in the day, and he was focusing on the Iranian threat. He said that the deterrence measures that the United States has put in place with the aircraft carrier strike group coming in early, with bringing in the B-52 bombers, he says that that has put on hold potential attacks on Americans. And asked to clarify about that, he said, you know, it doesn't mean that the threats that we previously identified have gone away, but he did say that he believes the United States response has given the Iranians time to recalculate.
I also understand that the United States top military officer was scheduled to go to Europe to meet with NATO leaders, but that trip has now been called off?
That's right, Steve. I was actually one of the reporters that was supposed to be traveling with Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, today. Instead, he has been here in Washington. He has briefed members of Congress in that closed-door session. Also included in those briefings are Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and others. And he just felt, according to his spokesperson, he felt that he had so many meetings to attend here that he was better represented here in Washington. That does not mean that there's not a U.S. representative at these NATO meetings. General John Love is going to be representing the United States. He is the three-star military general that stays in Brussels, and he will be talking to NATO about readiness, enablement, and things of that nature.
Carla, what else can you share with us about the briefings on the Hill or what will be taking place in Europe at the NATO meeting?
Well, it's interesting that the Iranian threat has been discussed for such a long time, and they're just now getting to brief all the members of Congress. And once members hear the threat, if you heard Senator Lindsey Graham, they feel that the threat is real. The problem that the Pentagon Press Corps has been having is that we have not seen any of this direct intelligence. In fact, it's been really hard to get people talking to us face-to-face, going forward, putting their name out there to talk about this threat. But VOA just did get this confirmed earlier today. One of the Secretary of Defense's spokespeople, Lieutenant Colonel Joe Pacino, did say that U.S. intelligence has proven that it's highly likely that Iran is responsible for the attacks on the four oil tankers that came out. Secretary Shanahan hinted this earlier today when he said that there have been attacks by Iran. And so VOA, we decided that we needed clarification on exactly what he was talking about, and that's when we were able to get on the record confirmation that at least the oil tanker attack is directly being tied to Iran based on U.S. intelligence.
All right, that was VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb speaking to International Edition's Steve Miller. Kenya's high court is set to rule on Friday whether to uphold or nullify a colonial-era law interpreted as making gay sex illegal. Rael Ambour reports from Nairobi.
Stanley Mwasa, a gay man living in Kenya, says going to parties or events alone is always a risky affair. It is safer if he's in a group of two or three people, he says. In the past, he has been attacked by strangers, an experience shared by many gay and lesbians in Kenya, he says. He is hoping that on Friday, Kenya's High Court will overturn the law that he says has fueled homophobia for decades. The law he refers to are the sections of the penal code that make gay sex a crime.
There is no way someone is going to traumatize you, yet you have a right to go to any police station or any facility that gives justice. It will change. Everything will change. Even the police officers, the way they carry KPs, it will have to change.
In 2016, three Kenyan gay rights organizations filed petitions with the High Court asking it to declare sections 162A and C and sections 165 of the Penal Code unconstitutional. The organizations argue the laws violate the rights to privacy, the rights to freedom of expression, the rights to health, the rights to human dignity, and the right to freedom from discrimination. Court hearings began in February 2018. Otieno Namwaya is a researcher at Human Rights Watch. He says the laws, which date from 1930, infringe on LGBT rights and deny them access to medical services or police protection.
Even Kenya's own constitution outlaws discrimination of any kind. So it is illegal to allow discrimination on the basis of religion, on the basis of tribe, on the basis of race, on the basis of sexual orientation. So it is a contradiction for the Constitution to say on the one hand that any form of discrimination is illegal, but on the other we retain laws that actually discriminate against one section of the people.
Irungu Kang'ata is a Kenyan senator and a vocal opponent of gay rights who is also participating in the case. He says if the court strikes down the laws, he and his supporters will seek other avenues to stop what he calls the LGBT agenda.
We either appeal, but I foresee little chances of success in our judiciary, because I strongly believe our judiciary has been captured by non-government organizations. So the best case scenario would be to push for a referendum to amend certain article of the Constitution so that it's very clear that that behavior is not allowed in Kenya.
If the petitioners win, Kenya will be the first country in East Africa to decriminalize homosexuality. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
The United States is delaying restrictions on U.S. technology sales to Chinese tech powerhouse Huawei for 90 days in what it calls an effort to ease the blow on owners of its cell phones and smaller U.S. telecom providers that rely on its networking equipment. The Trump administration insists the sanctions are unrelated to its escalating trade war with China. Huawei is the biggest or world's biggest maker of mobile network gear and the number two smartphone brand. The U.S. claims Huawei is a cybersecurity risk and has targeted it against the backdrop of a wider trade war with China. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asks Michael Swain, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, why the U.S. has taken the stand it has with Huawei, and on a broader stand with China.
Some people say that this whole effort is part of basically a negotiating gambit on the part of Trump, right? He's trying to put pressure on the Chinese. The trade dispute is worsening. Their negotiations have basically fallen through and they're trying to get them going again. Trump is looking for greater leverage, the argument goes, and here's Huawei. This is a real source of leverage for him in trying to get the Chinese to agree to his trade goals. And if they do agree, then maybe he will relent. If you're talking about the U.S. position on this, it's partly an issue of the kind of access that Huawei could get to the U.S. internet system to be used for either spying or to damage the U.S. internet system because of the very wide use of Huawei devices and hardware. But I think it goes even beyond that. I mean, it really goes to the question of, is the United States going to try to insulate China or isolate China and its telecommunications and its electronics from itself and from the Western world? Is it trying to reinforce the idea of a electronic wall, if you will, in which you have two separate operating systems in the world, one of which is basically Chinese-oriented and the other one is Western-oriented or Western-allied-oriented?
Doesn't the decision by the United States to block Huawei in any way it's seemingly possible foster that, basically forcing the Chinese to come up with their own ways to complete their system?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what it's doing. I mean, this is part of the dilemma that the United States is in. Huawei relies a lot on American chips. It is not as sophisticated a producer, and China in general isn't, as I understand it. I'm not an insider on this, but I've talked to people who do know a lot about it. And there's a lot of supply dependency on the part of Huawei on U.S. manufactured chips and other hardware. And this action by the United States, if it follows through on it, will provide increased motivation for the Chinese to, in fact, separate that dependency and develop their own chips. Now, the question there is, of course, how long would it take for them to do that? And would Huawei remain viable as a company over the period of time in which it's trying to really reduce its dependency on U.S. suppliers? And some people say it can be done in relatively short order, and other people say, no, it will take years to happen. And in the meantime, Huawei could be in jeopardy of actually surviving as a corporation.
Well, apparently what has happened with the decision by Google to pull out, although it apparently has not been doing business with Huawei in China for a while, this just hurts Huawei's customers in China, not around the world. That will hurt their business worldwide rather than in China, in both ways. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of its devices that are used in China are also dependent upon U.S. suppliers. One other big issue here is European companies, as I understand it, are more dependent upon or utilizing Huawei hardware than in the United States. In the United States, apparently, Huawei is a supplier in rural areas of the U.S. for internet devices of various types, routers and that sort of thing. In Europe, though, I think the dependency and the distribution there is much greater. So the question there, I mean, you've already seen Europeans have tried to basically adopt a middle ground dealing with Huawei. The UK, for example, is putting the Huawei systems through an examination in which they're trying to seal off certain parts of Huawei from the UK government and then permit Huawei to operate in other areas. With this recent action by the United States to put Huawei on the so-called entity list of national security concerns or threats, it basically is trying to prohibit American companies overall from dealing with Huawei. It's not just U.S. government entities, which is the previous decision that the U.S. had made. It's now extended to U.S. companies writ large, civilian companies.
What has this done and what might this do in the future to U.S.-China relationships?
The United States now has identified China as essentially an existential threat. It's a threat to the global order from the U.S. position. It's a threat to American interests and American security. It's a revisionist world power put in the same basic category as Russia and Iran, and it's now being treated increasingly as if that is the case.
That's Michael Swain, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking to VOA Asia's Ira Melman. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Africa has become the world's most rapidly urbanizing continent. During the next 15 years, the United Nations predicts the world's 10 fastest-growing cities will be African. Nicholas Pinal looks at the issues and challenges of such rapid growth. Here he is his report from Paris.
In sub-Saharan Africa, the urban population has doubled since the mid-90s. It reached 400 million people in 2016. According to experts, 40% of the region's total population resides in cities, compared to 31% in 2000. However, the development of infrastructure and industries has not kept pace with the growth in urban population. 60% of city dwellers in sub-Saharan Africa live in slums, and only 25% have access to safe drinking water. Poor sewage systems and weak flood control present another challenge. Kuman Kosia Tamia is a traditional queen from Ivory Coast. She fears each rainy season and the floods they bring. She complains that when the rainy season comes, she cannot do anything. Everything is blocked. Amadou Diarra is a mayor of North Pekin, a suburb of Senegal's capital, Dakar. He sees human waste management as a growing problem.
Il y a d'abord le problème d'enfouissement de ces déchets parce qu'on n'a pas des usines d'enfouissement.
Donc, il y a he deplores that there is the problem of burying waste since they do not have plans to deal with it. There is only one site that receives all the household waste in the Dakar region. And this has consequences. The challenge in moving towards sustainability, he says, is to transform waste next where it is produced rather than buried underground. He says this is dangerous for individuals. Most of Africa's urban growth is in small and mid-sized cities. Slightly more than half of Africa's urban dwellers live in cities with population of less than 250,000. Maggie Chazal is the founder of the NGO Urbanists Without Borders. She says the intermediate cities are important to Africa's future.
Si les villes intermédiaires n'existent pas, on ne peut pas relier les grandes villes et la zone rurale. Et dans ce cas-là,
she insists that if intermediate cities do not exist, then we cannot connect large cities and rural areas. In this case, rural areas have neither equipment nor jobs. According to her, young people will leave these areas in an intensifying rural exodus. She says large cities only concentrate economic and social problems, such as slums. But Africa already has many large cities, and those cities are getting larger. Lagos in Nigeria is projected to become the largest city in the world, with an 88.3 million people population estimated by 2100, according to the World Economic Forum. Nicolas Pinot for VOA News, Paris.
Now, three handwritten wills have been found in the suburban Detroit home of the late Aretha Franklin, months after her death, the Queen of Soul, including one that was discovered under cushions in the living room. The latest one is dated back to March 2014 and appears to give the famous singer's assets to family members. Some writing is extremely hard to decipher, but the four pages have words scratched out and phrases in margins. Franklin was 76 when she died last August of pancreatic cancer. Lawyers and family members said at the time that she had no will, but three handwritten versions were discovered earlier this month. Two from 2010 were found in a locked cabinet after a key was located. The 2014 version was inside a spiral notebook under cushions according to an attorney for Franklin's estate. The wills were shared with Franklin's four sons or their lawyers, but a deal has not been reached on whether any should be considered valid yet. A statement from the family said two sons object to the wills. Sabrina Owens, an administrator of the University of Michigan, will continue to serve as Franklin's personal representative of her estate. In a separate court filing, her son Keycuff, Franklin said Aretha Franklin wanted him to serve as a representative of the estate in her 2014 will, and he's objecting to plans to sell a piece of land next to his mother's Oakland County home. A judge in April approved the hiring of experts to appraise Franklin's assets and personal belongings, including memorabilia, concert gowns, and household goods. Franklin's star, meanwhile, has not faded since her death. She was awarded an honorary Pulitzer Prize in April, cited posthumously for her extraordinary career. A 1972 concert film, Amazing Grace, was also released with much praise from critics. Been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director Tracy Carter and our engineer Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.